Beachley, 7-time world surfing champion, founder of Awake Academy and chair of Surfing Australia. I'm super excited to be on the couch today with Mark with this Straight Talking episode. And we're going to be covering off things like the power of a positive mindset, overcoming fear. There seems to be a bit of a dark web phase that Mark's been through on tour. We might explore that a little longer. And things about understanding the power of the subconscious and conscious mind and how we can embrace opportunities and take control of our lives. Stay tuned. I can put you on the spot.
Do you know what?
Come on, Mark. Introduce me.
No. I'll do the intro later. But you know what's really interesting, Lane? Well, for me, there's a couple of things. Well, first and foremost, I want to know, did you ever get one of these surfboards? It's an Inchal Mara surfboard. Like I just put it out there on the screen. Do you ever ride one of these surfboards, Inchal Mara's brand?
No, I've never even heard of them.
No, well, it's an old school brand, but it's around before you were even born.
Well, 1976, I see it says on your T-shirt.
Yeah,
is that correct?
1976.
Okay,
yeah,
I was 4 years of age, which was when I started surfing, but I wasn't mature enough to ride one of your boards.
Well, this is one of my boards, one of my first businesses. Whitey, eat your heart out, mate. You always wanted one of these T-shirts. No one knows who Whitey is, but
yeah,
mate, there it is.
And he's probably mortified that you bring it to him.
He's up there in Byron Bay watching right now.
Yeah.
So Lane Beach, when I was a kid, when I was 15, I remember going, I went out to Cronulla Beach and there was a guy there, blonde hair, good surfer. All the chicks thought he was hot.
You're talking about yourself?
No, it wasn't me. and long hair and he was great. And his name was Mick, believe it or not, Mick Bleach. Now, if I was growing up as a kid and I had the name Beachley,
yes,
I would have thought I'd just been blessed from above, like the name Beachley. I mean, how could you not be a surfer with a name like Beachley?
And now you owe me a dollar. Pay up. If I got a dollar for every reference.
100 times. But seriously, it was growing up like that, you had no choice. Especially on the northern beaches.
I had a choice. I actually loved playing tennis and I chose surfing over tennis because surfing was way more fun. And I loved being in the ocean, loved being in the sun. I mean, in the tennis court, you're in the sun all the time, but there's no ocean to go and refresh yourself after.
Well, would you tell me why did you take up surfing? Like, and when did you take up surfing?
So I took up surfing. Well, my dad introduced me to surfing. So he's been a clubby, a Manly Surf Club. He was actually just granted life membership down at Manly Surf Life Saving Club.
You should see, Lane just said clubby, and I haven't heard that for like 40, 50 years maybe.
Jeez, you're so out of touch.
Clubbies,
where have you been hiding?
Clubbies weren't cool relative to board riders.
No, they were the enemy. Antithesis to fun for me.
And a clubby, someone who worked in a surf club or it was a lifesaver.
Yes, they put on those red and yellow caps and stood on the beach and told everyone where they could or could not go. They put up flags right where the best waves were.
Correct.
To prevent us from being able to surf there.
So board riders, generally speaking, didn't like clubbies.
No.
So your dad was a clubby.
My dad was a clubby.
At Manly?
At Manly. My older brother Jason's a clubby. At Manly, and I just saw the whole movement as something that was a complete waste of my time.
So you didn't want to go on the surf club. You didn't want to go
and do
flags.
Wanted nothing to do with nippers and flags. I didn't want to be standing on the sand running after a piece of hose. Like that just seems ridiculous to me.
So what sort of kid were you? Were you like as a girl? Were you like tell me about brothers and sisters?
I have an older brother, Jason, who's 5 years older than me, and I have a younger sister, Catherine, who's 18 years younger than me. So she was born when I was 20, and then I no actually 20. Yeah, because I'm 48 now. And I have a half-sister who's 25 who lives in America.
Right.
So it's a very convoluted family unit, but ultimately my dad introduced me to surfing as a four-year-old. My older brother was surfing, so I just stole his board and went surfing.
Because it's pretty, like, you know, if you're going back 44 years, a young girl surfing wasn't something that was happening.
No.
That wasn't normal.
No.
Like, kids might be doing it, other boys might be doing it, I should say, but generally speaking, a four-year-old girl wasn't doing it. Even a 12-year-old girl wasn't doing it.
No.
So you were a tomboy, so to speak, as they say.
Nickname with Gidget, girl midget.
Gidget, wow.
Yeah.
So you're going back now.
Yeah.
A lot of people watching this won't even know who Gidget was, but like.
Tell the Googler.
Yeah, Gidget was uncool. It was uncool but cool. But uncool
you
today.
Are so
uncool
uncultured.
Today. But then so cool. Like, it was the only thing on television worth watching. So you decided that, well, I can do this. Did you conscious decision or your dad said, come on, I think you can do this?
Dad introduced me to it and I never recall seeing the ocean as an environment that I didn't belong in. It was more the guys that tried to influence that behavior or influence that mindset. But as far as being in the ocean, I felt like I truly belonged there. And I still do. It's my place of solace. It's where I feel connected. It's where I feel free. So that's why I kept going back into it, because I was so intrinsically attracted to it. And that's what really drove me to pursuing the career in surfing, is because, as you said, there weren't very many female surfers to aspire to or to be inspired by. And it wasn't a viable opportunity for young girls in the 80s to aspire to become a world champion surfer.
Did you have, when you were, four is probably a bit young, but maybe when you were 7, 8, 9, 10, was there a female surfing or otherwise in a competitive sense? You know, we just heard Helen Reddy pass away, a great female icon, sort of around that time. Mm. You would have been a bit young, but around that time.
Yeah.
Did you have a female competitor in any sport that you found that aspirationally attractive to watch or to follow or to be involved with or to maybe copy?
I never had heroes. And why I say that is because I never put anyone on a pedestal and wanted to be who they were. I always wanted to be me.
Most great sports people are like that.
Yeah, right. So I never wanted to go, I want to be just like her. It's like, once I became conscious of the fact I wanted to become a world champion, then I started to identify who are the best role models in that world champion status. And, of course, when you surround yourself with experts, you save yourself a lot of time. So I was able to just very clearly identify, especially in Manly, I had the advantage of being surrounded by world champions in all sports. But I particularly hung out with people like Pam Burridge, Wendy Botha, Tom Carroll, Guy Leach, Stuart Entwistle, Barton Lynch, you know, all world champions. And
in their various
disciplines. Yeah. And they inspired me. They shared their wisdom and knowledge with me. Wendy Botha tells the story that I was an absolute pain in the ass because I just kept asking how, why, what, how, why, what. Like, I just wanted to absorb as much information as I can possibly absorb.
Were you like that with everything or just in surfing?
Just mainly in surfing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you weren't a punish to your parents sort of saying, well, show me how to do this. Can I do this? Or to your brother? Or can you teach me something?
I'm sure I was a punish as a child in all sorts of ways. But
no, but were you at them all the time? Or is that your personality? Or or you just said, this is it, surfing's my thing and I'm going to learn everything I can?
Yes. Yep.
Was it something you made? Did you prosecute that like publicly to everybody that you wanted to be world champion, or did you just silently have it in your own mind?
No, I call it pen post proclaim. Like, I wrote it down, I posted it somewhere where I could see it as a daily reminder and everyone who knew me could see it as well. And then I proclaimed it to people who were closest to me and then also to the world. So when I joined the tour as a 17-year-old, I very adamantly proclaimed, okay, I'm going after a world title. And I said to Pam, I want to be a multiple time world champion. And her response was, settle down, Gidget, you haven't even won a contest yet. So you might want to just pull your head in and get a few wins under your belt before you start telling the world what you're going after. But I truly believe that to achieve success, you have a very clearly articulated vision to drive you in the same direction that you, or the, you know, that direction that you're pursuing. And if you're not clear, then you tend to be a rudderless boat at the best of times.
I like that because, I mean, I often say, business at least, the best or the most successful business people always prosecute the proposition. So, and they just tell everybody, get to a point where put yourself in a position like, shit, if I don't achieve this, I'm going to look like an idiot.
Yeah.
And you got to keep talking about it. There's nothing wrong with talking it up.
No.
I mean, a lot of people, sure, you might be setting yourself up for failure.
Yes.
But so what? It's, you know, if you fail, you fail. I mean, like, you just got to go and do it again. So, I mean, I'm interested to hear that. I mean, and the other thing I have to say to people too is it's interesting you should say that about you didn't have a particular iconic person. You just went out and borrowed things from everybody who was successful. Sometimes I think, again, pitching someone as I want to be him or her, that can be a mistake. Because you've got to be yourself.
Yes.
Just borrow bits and pieces and try what works out for you. And I never worked that stuff out until I was in my 40s. You've worked it out like when you're a teenager.
Yes.
Who guided you in this area?
I feel like I was self-guided, but I was also guided by friends and family and school teachers. I mean, I still remember so distinctly my year 9 school teacher saying, learn how to say thank you and you'll be a success. I thought, that's really simple advice but so profound. And I was 15 years of age. I thought, okay, I've got to remember to learn to say thank you. But in regards to recognizing or acknowledging that I didn't want to be like anybody else, I wanted to be the best, or, you know, I just wanted to be me, I just feel that that was an intrinsic motivator, and maybe that I saw people who were extrinsically motivated being too easily influenced or persuaded, because I knew I was unconsciously aligned with my values, because I'd never really articulated what my values were as a teenager. But I still can remember, say, for example, I'm 15 years of age, I've got a contest coming up in a couple of days, and my girlfriends, because I went to an all-girls high school, wanted to go out, they wanted to party, they wanted to be drinking, they wanted to smoke, and I just saw that as a complete distraction from my ability to surf to the best of my ability. So I just went, I don't want to be a part of that. So I was never really deeply persuaded by peer group pressure, because I saw that as a distraction or a deterrent to being
a good surfer. That's interesting you actually articulate that in yourself at an early age. I mean, I often say, it's nearly like a proverb, unrewarded talent.
Yeah.
I mean, we hear about, you would have known them too, other people who were great at what you did or great at a sport at school who should have gone to somewhere, but they never got there because of the very fact they didn't have the discipline to get there. I mean, we see this in business all the time. People who are really, really smart come up with a great idea, but it just dies off because they couldn't give a fuck about it, and they just go out and they say, okay, well, Friday night I'm going to get on the piss, and whereas their competitors or the other people doing well, Saturday morning they're waking up at 6 a.m. and they're working on their whatever their pitch is or whatever their business proposition is, or whatever their strategy is, or they're reading everything they need to be reading about. So the same goes for athletes.
Yes.
You've got to be committed.
Yes. And I'm glad you said committed, because it's not just discipline. And there does have to be commitment. When I used to train with Rob Roland Smith, the Prince of Pain, the Sandhill Warrior, he used to have this T-shirt or this singlet on, and down the back of it had the vitamins for victory, and it went from A down to F, and it was attitude, belief, commitment, discipline, enthusiasm, and fun. And they were the vitamins that we had to take every single day if we wanted to be the best that we can possibly be. But there's a lot of other fundamental contributors to a person's success. And one of the reasons why I created this academy, I know we're going to talk about it in a minute, but it was to simplify.
Tell us what the name of the academy is.
Oh, Awake Academy.
Okay.
One of the reasons I want to talk about it is because, one of the reasons why I wanted to create Awake Academy was because I wanted to simplify the overcomplicated process of succeeding.
Or the perception of it.
Or the perception of, yes.
I'll never get there because, Lane is white, Northern Beaches, she had all the help in the world. These are the perceptions. She had all the help in the world, and she didn't have to worry about this, and this,
Excuses, reasons, and stories.
100%.
And we've got
I'm fucking sick of it. Like, everybody says it, I mean, over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
You weren't privileged in any particular reason. I mean, if you had some slight privilege, I mean, maybe you're not coming from a terrible socioeconomic background, but at the same time, if you hadn't had the commitment and the discipline,
yes,
then you would never have got there.
No. But there was also an intrinsic driver that fundamentally pushed me in the way that I needed to be pushed, and that was my fear of rejection. And that emanated from being told I was adopted as an 8-year-old. So Dad, was very loving and nurturing, but what I chose to hear was the opposite. So while he's saying, "You're my baby girl, you've always belonged," I've chosen to hear, "I've been rejected and I don't belong anywhere."
Well, when you're 8?
When I'm 8.
You actually went through that process?
Yeah.
So can you just mind explaining to everybody what that's all about? So at the age of 8, why did you find out at 8 years of age your mother passed away?
So Mum passed away when I was 6.
Yeah, your adopted mother.
My adopted mother. And then Dad noticed or recognised that there was kids around the street that were asking why I looked so different to the rest of my family, because they're all 6 foot plus and pasty white skin and brown hair and brown eyes, and I'm 3 foot nothing with dark olive skin, blue eyes and blonde hair. It's like, okay, where the hell do you come from? Yeah. And once kids start questioning me, I start questioning myself. And so Dad thought, well, the worst thing he can do is allow someone else to tell me.
Yep.
He had to tell me.
Yeah.
By the time I'm 8, it's too late to tell me though. My brainwaves have shifted to a point where I can judge, criticize, analyze, and then instead of being open to it, I'm going to create a parameter of fear around it, and that's exactly what I did.
So what do you mean by fear? What did you fear?
Well, I feared the fact that I was never deserving of love. I feared, and I made up
was
this.
Was it like guilt or something?
No, I just created this story in my own mind that if my mother didn't want me. My biological mother didn't want me. Now, I didn't understand the circumstances around the adoption. I was too young to even know what that meant. But I just had decided in that moment, okay, I don't belong here. My own mother didn't want me. So what am I going to have to do to be deserving of love? Like, what am I going to have to do to feel like I belong or to feel like I'm enough? I know if I become a world champion, everyone will love me because everyone seems to love world champions. Mm. So, okay, I'll just become a world champion. Now, as an eight-year-old, I wanted to be a world champion at everything I played. So cricket, soccer, golf. No, actually, I was really shit at golf and I still am, so I don't play it. But cricket, soccer, hockey, tennis, basketball, you name it, I played it. And if I felt like I was good enough at it, then I'd declare that I'm going to be the best at it. But surfing was that passion, that sport that I just kept thinking about, daydreaming about and wanting to be a part of. So I just decided to let all the other sports go and pursue surfing from about the age of 15.
So I find it sort of, I mean, I don't come from that environment, so I don't understand.
Where do you come from, Mark?
Mum and Dad. No, I'm doing the interview. Hang on. No, but maybe we'll do one with you.
Yeah, can
we'll
I interview you? That'd be lots of fun.
No, I'd love to do that another time. But like, it might do your fucking head in though. But,
it already has.
It'll do my head in. But I don't understand. Like from 8 to 14. So during that period, you felt as though, notwithstanding whatever your dad was doing, he was obviously being a good father. And your brother and your younger siblings, you know.
Well, they weren't born yet.
What about your older brother?
Older brother was the only, yeah, he was 5 years older than
me. Is he a biological
he's
brother?
He's my brother. He's my dad's biological son.
He's your dad's brother. He's an adopted brother, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the little black sheep of the family. Yep. So Valerie and Neil and Jason are the biological unit. Valerie had problems giving birth to Jason, which is why they had to adopt me when he was five.
Right.
And then she died 6 years later.
Did you ever feel as though you weren't part of their unit?
No, I never felt that.
Right.
I always felt part of the family.
So you felt part of the family, but at the same time you felt as though, well, why did my biological mother
never want me?
Yeah. And so you threw yourself into a sport, like into sport or generally, but like you threw yourself into being liked.
Yes.
I want people like me. And by the way, we live in the like world now. I
mean, it's a lot toxic, worse than
ever
it
has been. But that was sort of the same sort of thing. You wanted people to pat you on the back, say, oh, that's Elaine Beachley. She's a champion. Is that the sort of thing we're talking about?
You know what? It was a double-sided coin because, yes, I wanted to be recognised and validated, but quite honestly, I was just wanting to prove to the world that I was enough, and I had defined success as becoming the best of the best. So don't just give me one world title. Let's look at the record books and see how many I have to win to earn that mantelpiece.
Well, you got there. I mean, you're the most awarded male or female surfer in our history. Would that be right?
Well, Kelly Slater's the king.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he won 11, but he only won 5 in a row.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Such an underachiever.
Mate, I'll put something up on your Instagram about this. But, like, but seriously, you are—I mean, you got to that iconic status.
Mm.
Do you make money doing this stuff?
Yeah,
yeah. It was good earner.
It was decent.
How do you make money out of it? Like, is it sponsorship or what? Is it?
Sponsorship, yes. And prize money wasn't there. Wasn't much prize money. I mean, the year I won my first world title, I think was the most lucrative year I had on tour, and I won $75,000 US in prize money that year. So that was a big year for me.
How old were you?
I was 26. It was in 1998.
I was going to say it's going back 20 years.
Yeah, still, I mean, it's not enormous amount of money. And I was being paid 35 grand a year from my sponsor.
Yeah, so 110 grand a year.
And the tour cost me 70 to do.
And you got to pay for your travel and everything like that. Yeah. So you make 30 net out of it. Yeah. So it's not that good.
No, it's not that good.
So, but you weren't doing it for career, or did you?
I wasn't doing it for money. Money's never been a motivating factor for me. I've never based any real decision on money. And I trust that money comes and goes like the tides. So I just allow it to flow through my life. I don't base the quality of my life on how much I own. But in saying that, there's got to be money for you to afford to do what you do. So when I was younger, I've still got my budget ledger of how much money I was earning, how much I was spending. And I was earning $8 an hour. And I was working from, you know, 6 at night till 3 in the morning at the Old Manly Boat Shed, for example, and never being paid overtime on weekends or weekend nights. And so I was earning probably around about $400 a week, and I was able to live off of that. But I was also paying for entry fees and travel and accommodation and food and all those kind of things. So I was scraping by for the first couple of years, and it wasn't until I won my first world title that it was almost like, oh, well, now you're world champion, now we'll consider paying you. But up until that point, I had to continuously prove my worth, and it was a real struggle.
Just from listening to you then, my gut feeling is, is you're a perfectionist.
I was.
You were.
I was. Yeah, and, absolutely. I'm not anymore.
And what I mean by perfectionist is that everything was – had a little place to go.
Yes.
And everything was dotted and crossed.
Yep.
And it all flowed nicely. It had logic associated to it.
But it was control.
It was all control.
That's what perfectionism.
And a lot of times when people have control, when they overlay the lies of control, it's about fear. They're scared of something.
Yeah. And that's what perfectionism is, the avoidance of criticism and judgment.
Mm. So you would openly accept that now. Did you accept it then?
No.
Did anyone ever tap me on the shoulder and say, what are you doing?
What the fuck are you doing? Like, you're not going to be able to get every grain of sand off the floor.
Yeah.
So you might want to.
The surfers aren't normally like that. I mean, no. Borderize, they're just.
Well, that's your perception.
Chilled. You know, like hanging out with their mates,
drinking beer,
going to Byron,
cruising.
You know, never enough money. Because, I mean, you said to me money wasn't a thing that.
Wasn't a motivator.
But not a motivator. But at the same time, you had everything. Bank structured like this, it was all within a lockstep, everything.
Yes, absolutely.
How much that was involved in your success? Do you attribute success to any of that?
Do I attribute my sex? Do I attribute my success?
Well, let's talk about that too. That's the next part of the interview.
Well,
and we'll put that.
That's the X-rated version.
Tour. Tor, you got.
What's Tor?
It's the dark web.
Is that your web?
No, not my. It's everyone's web. I mean, I can't say I know much about it.
Well, you knew the name of it. Yeah. I've never heard.
I'm actually trying to get it off my smart device at the moment because I've got the Tor app on there, and I just happen to look around what goes on in there. And it's a bit scary.
Did you learn anything?
Yeah, well, not that I learned anything, but I saw myself there a couple of times. So I got a bit worried.
You're going to be in the male version of Kim Kardashian. When's your sex tape coming out?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
It's already up. We got to search.
But you've got to go on a Tor. You've got to peel back the layers of the onion, as they say. But anyway, let's just move on here.
We're going down a rabbit hole now, aren't we?
But how much of this was attributed to your success?
Okay, in the early years, how do you define success, right? In my early years, I would attribute my failures to it because I was inflexible. I wasn't able to adapt. I didn't have this malleable mindset or this growth mindset. I had a very fixed mindset, and that was obviously clearly defined in my regimented processes. And if it didn't work out, then it was the process's fault. It wasn't my fault.
So what would you do? Like something didn't work out, what would you do? Would you beat yourself up?
Beat myself up. I just wanted to smash my board, bore my eyes out, blame the judges, throw rocks at my competitors. Like I was just angry.
Yeah, yeah. So you were ruthless in the pursuit of those things that got you to become successful.
So if
you didn't get there, you'd be filthy.
And that's because my self-worth and identity was wrapped up in my success, which meant when I was up and successful, I was euphoric. And when I was down and depressed, I was in a very dark, when I failed, I was in a dark, depressed state.
So I love Joey, he's a great bloke, but a bit of bipolar there. I mean,
I wasn't bipolar. I was just relentless. I was unrelenting. And I was fierce. And if I could take what I know now and apply it to back then, I would do it very differently. I won 7 world titles. I won 6 in a row. I won 5 in a state of fear. So world titles 1 and 7 were won in a state of love. And what that looked like was letting go of the outcome. I can create a much better outcome.
Yeah,
let go of the outcome.
Because you enjoy the way there.
I enjoyed the processes.
Yeah.
And I wasn't regimented about the processes. I just focused my attention on the process at the time that it demanded my attention. I knew more about my equipment than my peers. I was more fit and healthy. I knew more about nutrition. I knew more about how my body responded and how much time it needed to recover. I went into the shaping bay with my boyfriend at the time, Ken Bradshaw, and learned how to shape my own boards and run my hands over them and feel the idiosyncrasies that you need to feel to get the best out of your equipment. So I was better prepared than anybody. So
first and seventh.
First to sixth, actually. One to seven, I was that engaged. What shifted after winning my first one was the expectation I put myself under. So when I won the first one, I didn't know I'd won it because I thought I had to surf through another heat to earn it. And then they announced that I'd won it and I went, oh, okay, all right, let's celebrate. But now I've still got a job to do because I want to finish the year and I want to win more events and, I want to keep growing and improving. But when I came to world title number 2, which is 1999, now all of a sudden I think I have to be twice as good as what I was in 1998. Yeah. And it was just unacceptable and it was painful.
in a chemical sort of way, like in within your own body. Mm. I mean,
tension,
stress, and tension produce cortisol.
Yeah,
and it's sort of like poison. It's not a great feeling. It doesn't feel great. I mean, it's obviously drove you to win the next world title, but at the same time, you're not enjoying the process.
No.
I mean, in business, it's the same thing. A lot of people put themselves under intense pressure. Mm. I wonder whether or not there's a lesson in all this for everybody listening to this. And I mean,
that would be the intention.
Yeah. That's what you're trying to produce now.
Yes.
Sort of. Is it about sort of trying to enjoy? I hate using the word the fucking journey.
But I know. I really do too. Like, it's such a cliche. Enjoy the journey.
But is it about
what
that?
Is the journey?
Is it about that? Like sort of trying to enjoy it. I mean, it doesn't mean you do it all the time.
Trying is you might as well be pushing shit uphill as well, because trying is the opposite of trusting. Trying is pushing and pulling and striving, and yet you're never thriving because you're always trying. So I feel that we need to take these words out of our dialogue and out of our daily communication. Stop hoping, because to me that stands for heaps of plausible excuses as to why it can't happen. It's a great acronym, you know. Yeah. If you're going to keep hoping, then everything outside of you has to almost fall into place before you can. And so stop hoping, stop trying, stop thinking about it, stop guessing it,
and maybe start stop fearing it
and start feeling it.
Right.
Now, when you said when we put ourselves under pressure, it brings up all this cortisol and adrenaline, and it's not a good thing. Well, at times it is a good thing, because I love feeling fear, because it brings my presence and my awareness back to the present moment. So I'm very clear when I'm in fear. But if you're relying on that day after day after day, you will end up with
– sick.
Yeah. Yeah, you'll end up with chronic fatigue like I did twice. You'll end up with depression. You'll end up with all sorts of serious health concerns, physically, mentally, emotionally. You're going to – basically drive yourself into the ground. And how sustainable is that model to success?
That's a short-lived life. It's a short-lived life. I mean,
yeah.
And a lot of people, you know these people, I do too, they turn to drugs and alcohol because that's the escape.
Sedatives and stimulants.
Yeah.
That's how they get through.
I'm down, I'm up. I mean, then that becomes a bit of a cycle. And I mean, this happens in business all the time too.
Like, yeah.
And right now, for example, people in Victoria, to pick a place.
Yeah.
You know, I've got like 60 branch owners of the Albert Grove business down there, and I know they're all feeling pretty tough. Because they're all fearful of their future. They're fearful of the value of their business. They're fearful of the assets they own. They're fearful of whether the superannuation is going to be enough. They're fearful of they're going to have enough income to pay their mortgage. They're fearful of a million things.
Mm.
And so are our customers down there.
Mm.
I mean, what would you say to these people right now?
Fear doesn't exist in the present moment unless you allow it to. Now it's reasonable to have fears about the future, but if you allow your future fears to dictate how you approach the current moment, then you're sabotaging your present opportunity. So if we're constantly thinking about the future, it increases our levels of anxiety. And so then our heart rate rises, our minds start racing up, we lose control of our emotions, and then we're not in a state where we're creating clarity around what's our choice right now, what can I do right now to create more certainty in my life. And then we'll start projecting. So we project into the future, it increases our anxiety. We reflect into the past, which increases our anger, because you start thinking, why did I do that? I can't believe I did that. I'm such a fool. That was so stupid. And the only thing that we can control is how we feel in the present moment. So,
but how do you do that?
You breathe. It's a really simple technique. It's called breathing. We take it for granted. I like teaching people a technique called the box breath. It's literally a 4-second inhale, a 4-second hold, a 4-second exhale, and a 4-second hold. And you do that once and you'll notice an immediate state of calmness. And that's what we need to create to establish clarity in our minds to then choose how we respond to the stimulus. It's not what happens to us that defines us. It's our response to it that defines us. So if we don't take the time to create the space to choose how we respond to the stimulus, then it's everyone else's fault. And then we become a lay blamer. And that's the kind of competitor I was before I won my first world title. I was an absolute lay blamer. It was everyone else's fault. The ABCDs.
I'm a victim.
Yeah, I'm a victim. This is always happening to me. That's the victim mentality. The champion mentality is this is happening for me.
Right. So to make me better?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's up to you to determine.
Instead of saying, why is this always happening to me?
Yeah, which is, that's the victim mentality.
This is happening for me.
Yeah.
Mark, do something about it.
Yeah. Or sit in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Cop it sweet.
Or recognize that you're afraid and ask yourself, why am I afraid? And how many of the answers do I have any control over the outcome of?
So where did you get the wisdom from? Like, where does this shit come from?
Surfing?
Yep.
Life lessons, reflection, emotional work.
That's what I want to talk about now.
Yeah.
Because surfing, to me, I mean, I haven't surfed many years now because I just can't be bothered going with all the crowds. But,
but
one of the things I used to love about
you go on a boat trip and find some hot waves
on
your own.
My brother owns a business, as you probably know. Surf. Yes. but you can't go away, you know. But like,
yeah.
But the thing about surfing that I used to love is the meditational side of it.
Yeah.
And most people, if they haven't done it, they don't understand what we're talking about. The thing is, we're all talking about airy fairy shit here, but we're not.
It is about breathing. Smoking school dropouts.
Yeah, but it is about breathing, though.
It is,
and it's about being in nature. I mean, to me, nature is the greatest thing that just calms me down, brings me back to where I need to be.
Yes,
whether I'm walking in the bush or I'm sitting out there in the water.
Mm-hmm.
So. Are you saying to me that this is where you've drawn some of this sort of, let's call it wisdom, mm-hmm. some of this wisdom from?
What else would you call it?
Well, it is wisdom, I guess. Mm-hmm. But also knowing to breathe, or did someone come and say, listen, Lane, you got to learn to breathe. Like, I know I don't. Like,
Yeah, when you stress, you have these short, sharp, shallow breaths.
Forget to breathe.
And then wonder why. You actually probably forget to exhale. Mm. You're like,
which is what happens when asthmatic. Yes. It's not that they can't breathe in, they can't breathe out.
Yes, yep. And that's because now you've robbed your brain of oxygen, you can't think clearly, and then you'll start getting headaches and fatigued, and so then you'll stimulate yourself with coffee to then create some sort of clarity or awareness or energy, and then that becomes your self-fulfilling prophecy. So shining a light or accepting the fact that you've created this state is the first state of awareness. So it starts with awareness or acknowledgement that, okay, I'm responsible for how I behave. Surfing has brought me a lot of clarity and awareness, but that's because I've become connected with how I feel. We're going through a time, probably thanks a lot to social media, is that we've also always been told that we're not allowed to feel bad, that we've always got to be feeling good the time. It's showing vulnerability, showing weakness, that's weak, showing that you're not on top of it, that's weak. Never let your competitors know that you're exhausted or tired or feeling down. And that's bullshit. Because we go through undulating emotions and just allowing them is what enables them to process. But if we don't allow them, then we hold on to them and we harbor them, then they manifest themselves in other ways. So I've just become aware of how my emotions make me behave, and then I can become aware, or then I can choose how I want to feel. So I start my day thinking about how I want to feel. My life, my vision isn't about what I want to achieve.
So when you wake up, tell me what happens.
When I wake up, I do the box breath.
Yep.
Take a deep breath in, hold it for 4 seconds.
How many?
I do four rounds.
Yep.
So it takes about a minute.
Yep.
Or two. And then I have a mantra in my mind.
Yep.
I don't know if you want me to go through the whole mantra.
Yeah, I like to, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So I read this very dry book called The Power of the Subconscious Mind by Joseph Murphy. And to put it into context, to save you having to read it, what he suggests is that our conscious mind, we think our conscious mind rules our life, but it's our subconscious mind that governs 95% of our behaviors in our life. So our subconscious mind is where our ego, our values, our beliefs, they all reside in our subconscious mind. It's kind of the classic picture of the iceberg. What you see on top is only 5% of what's going on below. So that's how our subconscious minds and conscious mind work. Our conscious mind is the captain of the ship, so it sets the direction. Our subconscious mind is the fuel engine or the steam engine, so it's fueling the engine of the ship. So if our conscious mind says, I want to succeed, then your subconscious mind says, okay, yep, let's make it so. If the next moment your conscious mind goes, I'm an absolute failure and an idiot, your subconscious mind goes, yep, okay, let's make it so. Your subconscious mind cannot rationalize or justify or question or doubt you. It just makes everything so. So if you're super inconsistent with your thought patterns, you'll create an inconsistent performance, which then relates to an inconsistent result. So what I became aware of in my early years of my career was my inconsistent mindset. One day I was up, the next day I was down. One day I believed in myself, the next day I sabotaged myself. One day I'd show up to training, the next day I'd show up drunk. Right? So there was a lot of inconsistencies, and that all came down to the fact that I had a massive fear of rejection, and I had judged success as being put on a pedestal and therefore rejected. So I had a fear of success, not a fear of failure. Failure was a stepping stone to success, but fuck, I feared success. I did not want to be put on that pedestal because I didn't want to be unliked. I didn't want to be rejected. So when I became aware of this, and after reading this book recently, I thought, what are some of the stories I subscribe to, or the stories that I tell myself that keep me stuck in a life that I don't enjoy? People used to say, you wait, we're going to go on holiday with Lane, she's going to get sick in the first week. And they were right. because that's the way I lived my life leading up to holidays. It's like, okay, I've got to get all this shit done and get all this shit done. And now I can relax and then my body would fall apart. And what fun is that?
Literally, that would happen to you.
That would happen to me all the time. And this is in retirement. You know, I've been retired for how long? 13 years. Anyway, I realized I needed to identify what were the weaknesses and then how can I flip them on their head and focus on what the strengths I need to enable me to maintain consistency. So, for example, when I wake up now, I do my box breath and then I give thanks.
What time do you wake up? Give us
an hour. 7.
7 o'clock. Okay.
Yeah. I like to sleep in because once all you briefcase bandits go to work, then I can go surfing.
Yeah, I got my briefcase.
Yeah, obviously. You forgot it today. All right, so when I wake up, I do my box breath and then I say, all right, I know the 3 things I need to focus on in my life to ensure that I show up as the best version I can be each day. Number 1. I am grateful for my fast metabolism because as a woman, I can be my world's worst critic. I can stand in front of a mirror and tear myself to pieces. So I say I'm grateful for my fast metabolism because it burns off every calorie I consume and that keeps me fit, toned and lean. And so therefore, once I'm saying these things to myself consciously, my subconscious mind then goes into the past or the future to find a reference point to match that. But if you're saying something negative,
to verify it, to validate it. Yeah, yeah.
So if you're saying something negative to yourself, your subconscious mind can instantly go into the past, find a reference point to validate that belief and then go, yeah, cool, yep, I agree with that.
Well, by way of example, if you wake up in the morning, you're in business and you think, this fucking Victoria is fucked, I can't get out to see everybody, my business is going to fail, you know, so immediately your subconscious is going to come and find something to affirm that.
Yes.
Confirm that.
Exactly.
So you've got to change your mindset.
Change your mindset.
What's the second one?
Second one is I'm so grateful for my strong immune system. Otherwise, I'm going to get sick all the time. And I'm grateful for my strong immune system because it detects any sign of illness or weakness or disease in my body and eliminates it, keeping me healthy, happy and strong. So then my subconscious goes back into the past, goes, oh, yeah, I remember when you were healthy, happy and strong. Cool, let's make it so. And then the last one is I'm so grateful for my powerful, strong beating heart because that sends fresh blood flow and oxygen to every cell in my body, keeping me warm, filled with energy and vitality. And then my subconscious mind goes, oh, I know how you look when you're full of energy and vitality. And that's how I start my day. And then I say that.
So you just hit each one, there's a common denominator in each of the 3 affirmations and they were gratefulness.
Gratitude.
So can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, so when we anchor ourselves in gratitude, it gives our whole mind, body, spirit, soul, whatever, state of awareness of the positive things in life. Now, I'm not saying we have to be positive all the time, and I honestly believe that if we refer to positive thinking as the way to get through negative events, that we're denying ourselves the pain and suffering that we've deserved to endure. The mistake that most people make is they stay stuck in that pain, suffering, and believe that that's the only way to deserve happiness. Mm. Whereas I've detached from that fear-based model now, and I know that that's a part of success, it's a part of life, it's a part of the human experience. But it doesn't control or doesn't demand my attention as much as it used to. So if you believe success has to be hard, you'll make it hard and you'll find ways to validate it every day. Mm. I believed as an athlete success had to be hard. But when I ground myself in gratitude and then you anchor it with why, it's one thing to be grateful. Yeah, I'm grateful for the lights. Yeah, I'm grateful for this communication or conversation. Yeah, I'm grateful for that friend. Why? Because then that gives meaning to each one of the things you're grateful for. Well, so that's
can you give an example of why are you grateful for your immune system and what would you say to yourself?
That's why I say I'm grateful for my immune system because it detects everything that's going on in my body and has the power to heal my body and it keeps me happy, healthy and strong. That's why I'm so grateful for it.
I mean, you don't have to go and does that sort of automatically sort of move you into the next phase? Well, and I'm not going to walk around with a mask on my – because if you start walking around with a mask on your face, just walking down the road 20 meters away from everybody and you put a mask on your face, is that an example of where you don't trust your own immune system and actually – you know, like to me, because I saw some people walking around this morning in like long gaps, they were nowhere near people, they're walking around and I thought to myself, by doing that, you're sort of telling yourself you're going to catch something.
Yes. Quite possibly.
I wonder
what the story that they're subscribing to, and all of us are subscribing to a different story, where they were believing what the health experts have to say about it, which we're trusting that they actually know what they're talking about, or whether we're saying to ourselves, I always get sick. I spend more time at the doctor than I do, you know,
so therefore I can't afford to catch this thing.
Yeah. So then we invest in the
Would
fear
you live your
and
life
struggle.
Like that then?
Yeah, then you live your life like that. So I choose to detach from that fear, and I choose to focus on what I do want versus what I don't want. And yet when you ask someone, what do you want? They'll most often start with what they don't want.
Yeah, that's interesting. And can I ask you about materialism?
Yeah.
Is that when you say what do you want?
I mean, yes.
How important are material things to you? I mean, where does that all fit into the equation? I mean, today, I mean, compared to when you were younger, I mean, you're 48 years of age, do you think to yourself, well, I want to be secure, and I want to have a house, and I want to have a car, and I want to have money in the bank so that I don't have to rely on anybody to give me any money, et cetera. I mean, do you think those things?
No, I don't. I never think those things. Every day I wake up, I think, how can I serve the world? That's what drives my decision-making every morning. It's like, how can I be better? How can I improve? What can I learn today that I can then share with somebody else to shortcut the struggle? So I'm not really ever motivated by materialism. I've never been materialistically focused. I remember actually I went and did a course in 1997 called Money and You, because I thought, I can't seem to manifest money into my life. I must have a block. And I had to write a vision of what my life would look like in 5 years' time. And this is the year before I won my first world title. And I found this folder when I was cleaning out my office a few years ago, and I read my vision and I looked around my house and I was literally living that vision. And I never mentioned how much money I was going to have in the bank. Now that you mentioned that, I think I've never actually thought about having a certain amount of money in the bank. And I wrote about where I wanted to live and how much light was going to be shining into the house. So it was more around the location than the size of the house. I was going to be a multiple time world champion. I was going to have a blue 4-wheel drive parked in the garage, which I currently do. I have a blue RAV4 parked in the garage. I have a beautiful house that overlooks the beach that has a lot of natural light coming in. I wanted a partner that surfed, but I don't now, but that's okay. I've snagged a rock star instead. And so basically I read this and went, wow, I manifested that. By just letting it go, like first articulating it and then letting it go. So materialism doesn't really play an enormous part in my life.
It's funny, you know, because in people always think that I've got some sort of mad drive to make shit loads of money and stuff like that.
And do you?
I've never have.
What does drive you?
I never thought. I try to change things. I'm always trying to change the way things happen.
So you're driven through disruption?
Not necessarily just not disruption in its hard sense, no. But just change the way things are and not accept the accepted way to do things and try and do it a different way.
Why do you want to change things?
I don't know the answer to that. That's just what turns me on. I mean, I just like doing it. I like to invent something or create something that does it differently to the way it's always been. And I'm anti-authority, so I tend to like to do things against the accepted norm and try and do it a different way. I mean, what
does that give you?
It gives me satisfaction that I could actually do something that no one else maybe thought of or no one – dared to venture into. Like, why would you take on the banks?
Right.
Like Australian banks, like the most profitable banks in the world. Why? You know, they're my world titles. That's for me was what I was always chasing. I'm not going to accept that. That's unacceptable.
Do you like to prove people wrong?
I like to prove myself wrong. So when I doubt myself, I like to prove to myself that I could do it.
Right.
So I like to be able to I challenge myself all the time. And even like COVID, for example, during this period, I mean, and I think a lot of people could resonate with this, and I use it to drive myself through hard times. But how is it that I'm not going to let this get better of me? You know, why? I mean, I obviously have my ups and downs. We all do. We have our ups and downs. But you know, there'll be days. But it won't last for me for long because I'll say, you know, fuck that. I'm not going to let this get the better of me, no matter what.
Right.
And I try to live my life by example. So as an example, I try to let other people see that. I'm not going to let this get the better of me and therefore maybe you're going to learn not to – you'll see that and maybe you'll live your better life and not let something get the better of you. Fear, for example. I'm a big opponent to fear.
Mm.
To me, fear is the greatest thief of imagination that exists. It steals from you.
It does.
And I fucking hate it. It's always there.
Mm.
You can't get rid of it.
No.
I can't eliminate it. It's always lurking. It's there, but it's about recognizing there and just shutting it down.
Right.
But I wasn't like that when I was younger. I mean, I've become that as I've got older. It's taken me a long time to learn. But
was there a moment when you felt like you actually learnt it, like you grasped the concept of it and went, oh, now I know how to manage this?
Well, it was a time I thought I grasped it, and it was a time when I made a whole lot of money, like a real lot of money, ridiculous amount of money, and I thought, oh, that's
What's
it.
A ridiculous amount of money?
Hundreds of millions.
Wow.
And I thought to myself, I'll never have to worry again.
Right.
And And that wasn't the case.
What happened?
Well, I started worrying about the money I had.
Oh, poison chalice.
And then, you know, material stuff. Mm. And then how do I manage this? Oh, shit. Oh, you know, I had 3 or 4 houses. So, well, hang on. When do I get to stay at them?
Yeah. When do I get to enjoy the success I've created?
This is so stupid. Like, you know, I've got to maintain them. Which is why I'm never, I only invested in these houses because I just didn't have to do with the money. So yeah. I bought houses, properties, bought a place of Byron.
Of course you would.
But yeah, because I always want to have a place of Byron. Like, I remember when I was, you can always rent one. 17, correct. When I was 17, I used to drive to Byron. I used to have the boards with my mates, have the boards on the roof. And we'd be driving about 1 million miles an hour in those days. And we have shit old cars. And I remember the boards flapping on top of the roof because the roof racks weren't very good or the boards weren't tied down properly.
Yeah.
And I always want to have a place up there I could just, don't have to take boards, put the boards there, go for surf and all sort of stuff. And the funny thing is, as soon as I did all that, I decided I don't want to really go surfing anymore because, you know, you get down to the crowded. Pass, it's too crowded.
Yeah.
You know, too many people. Oh, fuck this.
Surely you know people that have houses up there you could leave boards with.
Yeah, well, I didn't at the time, but yeah. I do now because everybody seems to want to live in Byron these days. But
yes.
It's funny, but I'm a big anti-fear person, and maybe because I'm full of fear. Maybe I grew up that way. Maybe I was made, although my parents have sort of indicated those sorts of things to me, but maybe I had fears and therefore I become anti-fear. Maybe. I don't know the reason for this, but I'm very acutely aware of fear and I'm very acutely of the place that fear must have in relation to your life, particularly when it comes to business.
Yeah.
Business is a potentially scary place.
Oh, it is. I've seen more sharks in business than I've seen in the water.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And then
it's
I say to people.
A feisty environment.
And I say to people, like, you know, the problem is, you know, in business is that the sharks are there and but you've got to feed a shark.
Yeah.
You've got to keep feeding it. Mm. But if you stop feeding, it'll come and get you.
Mm.
So you've got to be very, very careful about how you do this. You've got to control the shark by feeding the shark.
Right.
Just give it enough, but don't deny it completely.
Yes. Yeah.
Because if you deny it, it'll come and get you.
Right.
Eventually.
And that's your relationship with fear.
Mm.
So you're aware of fear. It's not like you're anti-fear. It's actually you acknowledge that it exists.
Yeah.
And you've just put it in a place that you need it to be, and you use it when you need it.
So my brother and I often talk about things like we compartmentalize things in our life.
Yes.
So we put things into compartments, and you know, I put something that's bothering me when I get home at night, and you know, business people can do this. I have an imaginary box.
Oh yeah.
And I put in the box and close the box.
Huh.
And I don't think about it anymore.
You don't write it down or anything?
No, I just put the thing in the box. I know what it is. It's in my mind. I put it in the box, an imaginary box, close the box. That's it. I'm home. It's in the box. Put the box away. And I'm not going to think about it again tomorrow morning. Tomorrow morning when I get up and I've done my things, I've, you know, been to the gym, I've had my breakfast, I've read the papers. You know, sometimes I meditate and I'm a breather like you're saying. I'm not necessarily the way you do it, but a different way.
Mm-hmm.
But now as I learned to breathe having done yoga for many, many years. Mm. I don't do yoga anymore, but I learned
not?
How to breathe. I just haven't had time. Well, my partner
haven't
at the time, she was a yoga
Come
teacher.
On.
No, I
haven't made the time.
And I used to go to her yoga classes and then I stopped going to once we broke up and I just never went back. That was about 5-6 years ago.
Right.
But I still do yogic things. You know, I just don't go to class is what I mean by that.
Okay.
But particularly in relation to breathing. But once I've done all that, then I open the box up again.
Oh, so you do think about it again.
Did I open the box again?
Okay.
The box is open. And what was it I was thinking about last night when I got home that I need to fix today?
Mm.
I'm going to fix it. But I do give, like yourself, I do allocate time first thing in the morning to myself.
Yeah.
Things for me.
Yeah.
You
things
know,
to boost you.
Reading, breathing, exercising.
Nutrition.
Totally nutrition. That's a big deal. Mm. And I'm not one of these people. You know, I got mates who don't eat from, you know, 5 o'clock in the evening till lunchtime the next day. I don't believe in that. For me, I've got to eat something, not a big deal, but just got to eat something. But also just indulge myself a little bit.
Yeah.
Just with no thoughts.
Yeah.
Just
how do you
do
nothing.
That? Just don't think. I don't think about anything. I just wander around. Oh, no, I've got to go get a coffee. I'm going to walk there. I'll see people. Hey, how are you going? You know, people, I go to the same place all the time. I'm very routine driven, so I go to the same place.
That
I know everybody
me.
There. And I go, but I know everyone there and I say good morning. Well, they're not friends. I mean, they're friends, but, you know, I mean, I'm friendly, but I don't go and hang out with them.
Mm.
But so it's just
acquaintances.
And it's just nice. It's no thought.
Yeah.
No challenges.
Mm.
Nothing. And then when I walk in the office, which is usually pretty early, I open up the challenge, the box, and the challenges start.
Do you have a time when there's multiple challenges that go in the box?
Yeah.
Or do you create multiple boxes or do you?
No, one box. Everything goes in the one
imaginary box.
And it gets locked. Yeah.
And that must have taken a lot of discipline to create that habit.
It has. And as you know, habits are the most important part of helping our behavior. Mm. So, you know, and it also helps me create the story about myself. So, you know, my story about myself, which is what we all do, we all create stories about ourselves and we confirm the story about ourselves. But you're talking about how your subconscious does it, you know, like in a neurological way. I mean, the more you repeat things, the more your brain just becomes neurologically used to doing it, conscious or subconscious, whichever way you want to deal with it.
Both.
I'm one for saying my story is that's what I do. I mean, I just told you, I put stuff in a box. That's who I am. Mm. And I don't worry about things post a certain time.
Right.
That doesn't mean Jiminy Cricket doesn't come at 2 o'clock in the morning and start scratching his hind legs over the top of my head. That happens too. But I'm, again, I do the breathing thing.
Right. What's your breathing technique?
Just deep breaths. I hold it.
In through the nose?
So I do the alternate nostril breathing.
Yes, yep.
I do that. And if it's in the middle of the night when you're half asleep, semi-asleep, it's just deep breaths in and I hold it and then I breathe it out. I don't hold it for four, you know, I don't come in for four, I don't do that
the
four
box
seconds,
breath.
4 seconds, 4 seconds.
Right.
But I do it for something, I count.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer in counting all the time.
No. Really?
Yeah, all the time.
You love numbers.
1,000, 2,000, 3,000.
Of course.
4,
it's always 1,000. In thousands.
Yeah.
Never in ones.
Totally. And
or tens.
Write down a hole in your breath when you're underwater and stuff. So,
I'm
a big believer in that methodology.
Mm-hmm.
Methodology works for my brain, works for my particular brain.
Yep.
It helps. Methodology and anything to do with arithmetic and maths,
mm-hmm.
you know, like just because it's nice and structured.
Yes.
It helps me come away from that your brain pinging.
Yeah. Ping, 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 ping.
Yeah. And the noise.
Pass myself in the
and, head. Like, I mean, I've been interviewing a lot of people lately about mental health and, you know, noise.
Oh,
and,
my goodness.
You know, we all go through this shit. I mean, like, I know, you know these people too. I mean, like, that we all got problems.
Yeah.
All of us.
Yep.
We all got fucking shit going on. Like, you know, and for me, what we all don't have is techniques, well, healthy techniques to help us control it. You know, like you're talking about breathing, I have healthy techniques. Just silly little things like the box, or I have a dog and the dog helps me. Like techniques are the most important thing you've got. As you get older, techniques work.
Yeah.
And you've got to find what works for you.
Yes.
By listening to people like you and maybe me, but listen to people like you and looking through the techniques. I want to talk a little bit about your new initiative. Can you just take us through that now?
Sure.
So how do people find out about it?
Well, it's a good technique to manage fear.
Correct.
And detach from fear.
So how do they find it first?
Awakeacademy.com.au.
It's a website.
It's all online.
Yep.
It's all digitized.
Yep.
And it's a online self-empowerment platform to help people detach from fear, take control and live a life they love.
Right.
That's the premise. The Academy was designed to cultivate growth, connection and confidence in humanity, and happiness. Like, I just want to create a happier humanity. At the moment, we're so invested in fear and struggle and pain and suffering that if we can just learn to do what you're doing is compartmentalize our lives. But to do that, we need to become aware of what are our current feelings? What's our relationship with our feelings? Do we deny our feelings or do we embrace our feelings? So the first, it's three chapters, seven rounds. So seven rounds to correlate with my seven world titles. You watch 19 videos and I was on tour for 19 years and there's 29 workbook exercises and I won 29 events. So that happened organically.
So people have to do things.
You have to do some work. You have to do the work.
Yep, yep.
And
otherwise all bullshit, just sitting there listening.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's not fluff. This is not a goal setting course. This is, I intend to punch you between the eyes a couple of times.
Yep.
So round one is and round two are about building awareness of your feelings, awareness of your stories, awareness of your strengths, awareness
of your drugs.
I ask the question, and I present it through videos and then they've downloaded the workbook and then they have to fill in their own stories.
That can be confronting.
It's very confronting at times.
And then do you sort of make suggestions or are you just going to leave it up to?
I share what my stories are to trigger initiative and trigger thoughts.
Right.
And then round three and four is all about building alignment. So alignment with who you truly are, what you truly want, establishing your I am mantra. Because the thing that I finish my mantra with in the morning is I am happy, I am healthy, I am fit, I am strong. That's become my accountability partner. Even on days when I wake up feeling hungover or foolish or guilty or sad, I take a deep breath and go, I am happy, I am healthy, I am fit, I am strong. What am I going to do right now that's going to get me closer to feeling one of those states? So then you create this I am mantra. And then you share these new stories which are now appearing through a rose-tinted lens versus the negativity lens, and you share that with your dream team. You start to establish your dream team, because growing up in Manly, there was a lot of dream thieves in my life. Plenty of people telling me I'm never going to make it. They're my dream thieves. My dream team are full of honesty barometers, people who elevate me, nurture me.
Like people, actual people.
People, yeah, people who bring the best out of me.
So choose who you hang around with.
Yeah.
Law make better choices.
Make better choices. So that's rounds 3 and 4. And then 5 and 6 is all about building, it's about awakening your spirit. So bringing in more play, more structure, more fun, more celebration. I introduce people to my 7 doctors, which are things you can bring into your life on a daily basis to enhance your overall health and well-being. Things like sunshine, laughter, rest, water, exercise. These things are really important that we just take for granted or even don't make the time for. So it's good to hear people like you compartmentalize your life, because that helps you put the structure into your life to prioritize your own health and well-being. Because the classic cliche is, when you're on a plane, if the plane starts going down, the cabin loses oxygen or loses pressure.
Put yours on first.
But yeah, if you're so worried about putting everyone else's mask on first, then you're going to be dying on the floor with no oxygen, and everyone's going to be sitting there unable to help you.
And everyone else will die too, because they're relying on you, because you built it such.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Which was what happens.
Yes.
Those people, like you just said, are the same people who go around, they actually want people to rely on them.
Yeah.
They build their life around that. And that's a bad thing.
That's toxic.
Totally.
Yeah.
And because that's control.
All you're doing is seeking validation and control. You're never going to be enough no matter what you do.
So your course, it's a course, isn't it?
It's an online course called Own Your Truth.
And how long does it go for?
Well, it's self-paced.
Right.
So it can take anywhere between 10 or 20 hours, or you can smash it out on a weekend if you're an A-type personality.
And what happens once you've done this thing and you're starting to you're feeling a little glum or something like that, or things have just gone a little bit out of control?
Yes.
Can you revisit it?
You can revisit it.
The whole process?
Yes. And we have a growth partner that's a part of our course called My Mirror, which is a psychological support arm. And they're a business that offer 21-hour advanced psychological counseling for anybody that's going through challenging times. So, and then we've got WWF Australia as our philanthropic partner, or Wakethropy, we're calling it. And they're our connection partner. And we donate $7 of every course back to them. And then My State Bank are our happiness partner, and I know the financial market doesn't get a rap for bringing happiness to people, but My State Bank are all about helping people's dreams come true, and they believe that financial wellness is the key to achieving that.
So maybe I'd like to ask you. I mean, we're going to run out of time, but I'd like to ask you this. It's important to me to know this, or to survey this, especially from someone like you.
Yeah.
When you talk about happiness, I mean, happiness is different for everybody.
Yes, it is.
What do you sort of mean by happiness? What do you, I mean, how do I articulate it?
Yeah. So for me.
Well, what's it mean for you then, maybe, is a good way of doing it? Because it's different for everybody.
It is different for everyone. And that's what the purpose of this course is, to help people define what makes them happy. Because most of the time we're seeking happiness, but first we're denying the fact that we may feel sad today. Mm. I can still feel happy when I'm sad. Mm. And I know that to transfer the emotion, I have to give the emotion time. I have to actually give myself time to sit in it. And, you know, we're afraid of sitting in the shit, but it's actually where the growth occurs. So happiness for me is recognizing what makes me happy and then taking the time to do it every day. And sometimes I do things that doesn't make me happy, or sometimes I deny myself the opportunity to do things that make me happy, and then I just have to recognize, okay, I've made that choice, so let's just commit to it, get it over with, and then go and do something and reward myself for doing something or make myself feel better. It's taking ownership of your feelings, and it's all about waking people up to own their shit and trust in love and detach from fear.
Like, they're waking people up to own their own shit. I mean, don't rely on someone else to do it for you.
That's it.
How do you – this? I mean, this is an interesting one, especially for younger people.
Yes.
The concept of divorcing those people who are punished,
yes,
who aren't good for you.
Yeah.
How the fuck do you do that? I mean, how does a younger person do that? Let's say they've got a mob of mates. You know, they live up in the upper North Shore, Northern Beaches, who all want to go and get on the piss every Friday night and just destroy themselves and, you know, borrow money or whatever. They're all getting themselves, they're just going down a rap, down a dark hole. So how do you do that and start again? Do you start again?
You don't start again. It all comes back down to you. Like, who do you want to be? How do you want to feel? What impact do you want to make? What difference do you want to make to the world? There's no deeper burning desire in every human being than to belong. And if you found a tribe of people that you belong to that you know is sabotaging your quality of life, then sooner or later you've just got to take ownership of the choice that you're making and say, I don't want to be this person anymore. And I believe that dissatisfaction is the precursor to change. You're not going to do anything different until you're dissatisfied with who you've become. And if you're not happy with that person, then now this is an opportunity to do something about
it. So is the key, Lane, is the key in order to –
look in the fucking mirror. That's
yeah,
the
correct.
Key.
You've got to sit and say, am I happy with who I am at the moment?
Yes.
Because I'm the person who's running this
yep.
game.
Yeah.
And if I'm not happy with the person I am at the moment, then I've got to move away from all those things that make me or and assist me to become this bad person.
The biggest issue is that moving away from everything at once.
Yeah.
That's the biggest challenge. And that's unreasonable.
Especially for a young person.
Absolutely. So you've got to find your allies. Find your one person that you are happy with and start spending more time with them and less time with the people who suck the life out of you or compromise your own values or convince you to do things that you know aren't congruent with who you are. But it starts with you. Who are you? Who do you want to be? How do you want to feel? And how are you going to choose to step into that role? Because like you were saying, you wanted to be a role model and so did I. I wanted to be a positive role model. I wanted to be someone who young girls aspire to not be like but can learn from. And if I'm going to behave in a way that's incongruent with that, then I'm going to let them down. So ultimately I had to take ownership of the fact that whenever I behaved in a way that was incongruent with who I truly am, I was just letting myself down. How long do you want to keep letting yourself down for?
Yeah, that honesty session, and it takes a fair amount of maturity to
yeah.
make that call.
It does, and support. You can't do it on your own.
Yeah,
so that, yeah.
And I feel sorry. I mean, I feel sorry, but I mean that there are people, unfortunately, who will never get there because they don't have the support groups.
Yeah, they don't. They haven't surrounded themselves with the right people or believe that they're not deserving of having those people in their lives. And I've done some amazing work with some really dysfunctional kids who have been let down by the system. And Mike Baird used to host this event called Project Uplift where he took seven mentors along with seven kids out of Oasis, for example, and we'd go and hike through the bush for a week. And they would have these monumental awakenings and transform their lives but then come home and fall straight back into the shit.
Yeah.
It's because they've detached from what they've learned and fallen back to what they know. So like you do when you challenge yourself to go, okay, I can do something better today. What's that going to be? I choose to do something different, whatever that is. It's up to the individual. But, you know, when these kids feel like they've been completely let down by the system, their parents are drug addicts or alcoholics, you know, they're in the home commission environments where they feel like they've got no one to rely on, it's very easy for them to slip through the cracks. And they're the people that really need to have the fortitude and the courage and the strength to go, okay, who do I want to be? And have the courage to look in the mirror. How many of us have the courage to look in the mirror and look in our own reflection?
Yeah, 100%. Not many.
No, that's what you need.
And can I, this whole COVID thing, I mean, like, you know the narrative, you know, they're blaming Bill Gates for it and they're blaming, you know,
Elon Musk
and the left and 5G and I mean, there's a million conspiracies, which, you know, some of them, they may be true. They may turn to be true. Irrespective of that, I mean, what do you think? Do you think anything positive is going to come out of all this? I mean, put the economic
stuff well, aside. I refer to it as a triple E reset, right? It's reset our economy, it's reset our environment, it's reset our own personal energies, what we focus our attention on. It's made us more aware. Well, for me, you know, I'm looking for what's been the positive for me out of COVID. Well, it's enabled me to actually dedicate the time to build an online course that's going to help people come out of this and transition out of this with more certainty and confidence and connection. So I'm really grateful for COVID because it slowed me down. It also made me realize that the unsustainable pace that I was living my life was going on a little too long. It's going to improve our capacity to communicate virtually as it has already. There's going to be some industries that may never recover from this. It's given us an opportunity to put things into perspective and prioritize what is important, what's not important in our lives. But like, you know, as we say, there's going to be some serious collateral damage through this, and that way we need to band together and support each other. So if anything, it's actually brought us closer together.
Well, at least here in Australia.
And here in Australia, yes. I mean, we're seeing divisiveness in America.
Yeah.
I mean, we're seeing some issues around the world, but ultimately
are you happy enough with where everything is in your environment?
Yes.
Like post-COVID, are you happy enough? Do you feel as though everything's okay?
Yeah, I feel like everything's okay. Because
yeah.
I know if everything turns to shit, I can just go surfing.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, do you still surf?
Every day.
Every day?
Yeah.
You're still living in Manly?
Still living, yeah, Queenscliff.
Yeah. So did you go for a surf this morning?
Well, here's the thing. I'm going to contradict myself. I do surf every day, but I fell down the stairs about 5 weeks ago sober and I've got some disc injury and something going on with my disc. I never put a title to it or a label to it because then it almost gives my body permission to harbour it.
I
just go, there's a bit of a challenge going on in my disc and my sacrum, and I'm just honouring that and letting the body heal itself. So I'm out of the water at the moment, but I'm still swimming every day.
And you're still getting in the water, you're not surfing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because I mean, that's one of the things I know it's when I surf too is sitting up on the board like that, I get a really stiff back, because I had a back operation. So I just thought, this is all too hard.
Yeah. That's why yoga would be so beneficial for you on a daily basis.
Yeah, but I should do at least once or twice a week.
There's apps on your phone. You can download it. 100%. You can do 5 or 10 minutes a day. It would be better than going to a class once a week.
Yeah, 100%. But I still exercise every day. After this today, I'm going to go wrestling.
Wrestling.
Yeah, I love wrestling. It's fun. It's cool.
Okay.
It's really cool. It's really cool.
Help you get rid of any anger.
You don't get tension.
You don't get hurt.
You don't get hurt because you're not getting punched in the head or anything. I box, but I don't.
It's not UFC style of wrestling.
No, it's not. It's not
cage fight.
It's just on the ground and
just rolling.
Yeah, roll around and sort of just getting in a position.
Still do that in COVID times?
Yeah.
Do you have to wear a mask?
Oh, no, I've only just started back up again. Five, 6 weeks ago. No, you don't have to wear a mask. 5, 6 weeks ago. But lad, I can do it. But
Nacho Libre kind of mask?
No.
Come on.
I could come out.
You wear a cape?
Listen.
No, don't worry. Become a character.
Don't worry. Sometimes I have a mask.
Or maybe we'll see that on tour.
I have the money. Don't go there. We've got to stop talking about tour. And it's embarrassing now. I shouldn't have even brought that up. We're going to have to edit the tour bit out.
I'm so intrigued.
You edit that out.
No.
Edit team.
Leave it in.
Staying in. Because the editor team yourself is going to stay in.
Well, Lane Beach,
this has been, for me, it's been awesome to sit down and talk to someone of your ilk. I hope you don't mind me saying that.
I don't know what that means.
Well, your stature, particularly
5'5".
Well, you might be 5'5" in a physical sense, but your stature, as a sports person, and I'm not going to say as a female sports person,
but
as a sports person, and the things you've achieved, but probably more importantly, the perspective that you've gained in your life, that's pretty cool. It's pretty cool stature.
Yeah, thank you.
From my point of view.
And I'm
a seeker. I'm always seeking ideas and truth. And one of the great things about my life, my business, is I get to speak to awesome people like you. And I get a little bit from everybody.
Yeah.
And actually, hopefully, it helps me improve the way I live my life,
mm-hmm.
or at least it reminds me of things that I should be doing or shouldn't be doing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I need to do more of, and I really get the breathing bit. I mean, I've been following Wim Hof. I'm not sure.
Oh, I've done that.
Yeah, he's a bit out there,
but still,
I've been listening to Joe Rogan. I've been watching Joe Rogan sort of interview him. I just think he's a bit too much.
Yeah. It's a bit extreme for me.
Too much.
I gave it a go.
You can't have a crack at it. You can have a crack, but you can't do it all the time.
No.
I thought I was going to have a heart attack.
An ice bath.
Going on, right. Yeah. I've actually got one on my farm and the ice bath thing. But I don't know, the heart feels like it's going to jump out of your chest.
Yes, it does.
And you think, hang on, maybe I'm a bit too old for doing this. Maybe. But I really appreciate
you'll find any excuse to validate it.
Totally. I really appreciate you doing this. It's been fantastic. It's a great episode of Straight Talk for us. Thanks, Lane.
You're welcome, Mark. Thank you.